Are you sure you want to go then? Asked Steve. I must, said Simon. Why? Demanded Steve, feeling suddenly annoyed at Simon's irrationality. In fact, he said, why didn't you just let the Americans take you? Simon looked up, but Steve refused to be unnerved by the dark expression in his eyes. I mean it, he went on. You say you're going to die soon, tomorrow, by the sounds of it. Steve's anger and frustration were coming to a head. Simon averted his eyes. So why not let Vice Admiral Fallon take you, he beseeched. You'd live a comfortable life on a secure military base, no one could get to you. And if you cooperated, who knows what they'd allow you. You might not be free, but at least you'd be alive. Steve sat back, as if he'd made a pretty convincing case. Simon said nothing for a while. His posture was closed, withdrawn, his eyes downcast. Then finally he spoke, in that quiet, arresting tone. Could you do that? He said. Do what? Asked Steve. The killer won't stop, said Simon, seeking out Steve's eyes with his own. Steve felt a familiar and unpleasant chill run down his spine. In 16 years they haven't caught him, said Simon. Who's to say they'll catch him at all? Steve stared into Simon's stone-grey eyes. If he doesn't take me, said Simon, he will take another. And suddenly Steve understood. So I will ask you again, said Simon. Could you live in safety while another took your place in death? No, said Steve, speaking as a man who'd faced a similar dilemma more than once in his military life. No, repeated Simon, and neither could I. Steve looked at Simon. He had an appealing face, the face of a nice young man, as Steve had thought from the first. But his eyes were those of an older soul. They were the eyes of someone who had known pain and fear. They were more like the eyes of a seasoned combat veteran than those of 20-something lad from the suburbs of Manchester. For 14 years, Simon went on, I've shared the pain and deaths of people who've died at his hand. I know, Steve, said Simon, his voice breaking with tears. I see what happens in the future. I can read the thoughts of people standing half a mile away. I can know places I've never been to. I know, repeated Steve, as Simon's despair climbed higher and higher. I've led the police to finding 21 killers, helped them with countless other crimes. I've stopped children running out in traffic, grounded planes that I knew would crash. Simon, please, said Steve, but not him. Said Simon, his voice rising close to a scream. Why can't I stop him? Steve could think of nothing to say. He had only recently come to believe in Simon, much less understand him. He was in no position to advise him on how to use his powers. He kills us, Steve, said Simon, desolately. He kills us in the most horrible ways. Steve did not want to hear this. He had just started to relish the fact that all this was coming to an end. Now it seemed like it was only the beginning. And he does not see it as a crime, Simon went on. He sees it as a duty, a divine vocation. We'll stop him, said Steve. No, we won't, cried Simon. He takes me, Steve. I've seen it. The only question is whether I die slowly at his hand or quickly at yours. I refuse to accept that, said Steve, stubbornly. You have no choice, said Simon. We always have a choice, said Steve, rising angrily from his chair and going over to stand beside the window. It's just that we don't always like the ones we're given. Simon watched him walk away, an enigmatic expression on his face. Steve stared out of the window, thinking that Monday could not come quick enough. Bankruptcy, homelessness, marital strife, these were manageable things, unpleasant, unwelcome, but manageable. Things he could understand, things he could confront. Visions of death and a psychopathic bogeyman were something else altogether. With a sigh of weariness, Steve reached out to close the curtains. He paused as the growl of an approaching motorbike rattled the window. A Harley-Davidson surged into view, closely followed by a large Suzuki and a second Harley. The bikes turned into the house next door, coming dangerously close to Steve's BMW, which was parked between the two driveways. "My new neighbors," said Simon from his chair. "Their mate moved in a few months ago after a spot of good fortune." "Lottery?" said Steve, relieved that the dour mood had lifted. "Littlewoods." Steve snorted his acknowledgement. "Things have been a bit rowdy since then," said Simon. Steve hesitated at the window. It was years now since he'd owned a bike. He'd sold his last one shortly after meeting Christine. She had not asked him to, but Steve knew she did not like them. She worried about him. That had been enough. Still, he missed it. Steve took hold of the curtains just as two massive trikes thrummed down the street. One of them made for the drive, but the turning circle was too sharp, and he ended up on the grass verge running down the side of the pavement. The second one made an even worse hash of it, coming too close to Steve's car and finding himself unable to maneuver either forwards or backwards. "Idiot," thought Steve, tugging the curtains closed. "I need to move my car," he said. "Sure," said Simon as Steve crossed the room. "I'll be just a minute," said Steve. But just as he was about to leave the room, Simon sat bolt upright in his chair. "No!" he shouted in a shrill voice of fear. "Why not?" asked Steve, coming to an abrupt halt in the doorway. For all the weird ways he had seen Simon behave over the last few days, he'd never heard him panic like that. "What's the problem?" asked Steve impatiently. The last thing he needed was more hassle over a damaged car. "I don't," began Simon, looking scared and apologetic at the same time. Then he got up from the chair and he stood there anxiously, wringing his hands. "No. Sorry, I think it's okay," he said. "Well, make up your mind," said Steve. He could almost hear the squeal of chrome on paintwork. "Go," said Simon. "I'll be fine." Steve sighed and shook his head despairingly. Then he trotted down the stairs and out onto the street. Simon was left alone. "Hang on there, mate," said Steve, as the BMW gave the familiar beep-beep of being unlocked.
"You didn't leave us much space to get in," said a gruff voice from further up the drive.
Steve looked up as several of the bikers ambled back onto the footpath, helmets in hands. They had a grizzled, unwashed look. They were not your fair-weather weekend bikers. These were the real thing.
"I know," said Steve. "Hang on, I'll move it back for you."
Just then, the rider of the maroon trike tried to reverse out of trouble, grinding the side of his engine up against the wing of Steve's car.
"I was just going to move it," said Steve with rising annoyance,
but the rider of the trike just stared at him from his open-faced helmet.
"Two wheels good, four wheels bad," he said in a voice that led Steve to think he was stoned.
"You're on three wheels, you fucking idiot,"
said Steve, having finally lost patience with these jokers. He snatched open the door of his car, slumped inside, and reversed his car back to the far side of Simon's drive. Then he got out, locked the car, and ignored the hostile stares that followed him back to the house. Steve was gone. The doorway yawned. Simon could not breathe. He could not move. He could but barely think. He had seen this before, seen it through the shadows and the fear. Now he waited for the hulking figure to fill the doorway and eclipse all hope. The rushing of his blood echoed loudly in his ears, and yet his heartbeat pulsed to a sluggish, swollen beat as time slowed and stretched before him. He lost all feeling of his physical self. Simon was locked inside his mind, and his mind was filled with fear, a fear that was validated as he appeared in the doorway. Steve rushed forward as Simon collapsed to the floor. He knelt down beside him, checked his pulse and breathing. He seemed all right, but for some reason he had passed out. The look of abject terror on his face when Steve entered the room had given Steve such a fright that he had felt compelled to look back at the doorway to check that Satan himself was not standing there. As Steve drew him into a more comfortable position, Simon began to come round. His eyes stared, unseeing, and he clutched at Steve like a child caught in the wake of some horrific nightmare.
"He was here," cried Simon. "He came for me."
"No one's here, Simon," said Steve firmly. "You're all right. You just fainted."
"No."
"I saw him," insisted Simon. "I saw him there in the doorway." Simon pointed at the doorway. A chink of fear opened up in Steve's mind as he followed the line of Simon's trembling finger. Steve clenched his jaw and slammed the door shut on the fear.
"You saw me,"
he said, almost angrily. Simon started to object, but Steve grabbed his chin and turned Simon's frightened grey eyes to meet his own solid brown.
"You saw me,"
he stated, with a finality that got through to Simon.
"I saw you?"
"Yes," said Steve. "You saw me. There is no one else here." For a while, Simon's wide eyes just looked up at Steve.
"Then I was wrong," he said, and at last there was something like relief in his voice.
"I guess so," said Steve.
"But I'm never wrong," said Simon, sounding puzzled.
"Yeah, well, join the club," said Steve, hauling Simon up and guiding him back to his chair. "Most of us spend half our lives getting shit wrong." Simon sank into the chair, the beginnings of a smile on his face.
"I was wrong," he said, again in a wondering tone as if he were entirely happy about the fact.
"So you said," said Steve, reaching for his unfinished bottle of beer. "I'm sure you'll get over it," he added, taking a much-needed swig.
"But don't you see," said Simon, sitting forward excitedly in his chair. "If I'm wrong about this, then I might be wrong about other things."
Some of the colour had returned to Simon's cheeks, and there was a brightness in his eyes. But the brightness had a manic quality to it, and Steve did not trust it. It was not like the many other shades and moods he had seen in Simon's gaze. This emotion was an imposter. This was not the Simon that Steve knew. The brightness was dishonest.
"Everything could be all right, Steve," said Simon, wonderingly, his gaze turning inwards as he tried to think things through in the light of this new experience.
"Yeah, of course it will be," said Steve, although he did not truly believe it. Steve felt suddenly flushed by a deep sense of weariness. Despite the eventual outcome, it had been a stressful day, a stressful week, in fact. He bent down and began collecting together the bags, cartons, and plates of their takeaway supper.
"What do you say we call it a day?" he said.
"It's still early yet," said Simon. But Steve could see the fatigue behind Simon's newfound optimism.
"It's dark outside," said Steve. "That's late enough for me."
Simon smiled.
"You might be right," he said.
He stood up and started towards the bathroom. Then he stopped and turned round, looking at Steve with that strangely intense gaze of his.
"That's more like the Simon I know," thought Steve.
"Thank you," said Simon.
"For what?"
said Steve.
"You said we."
"We what?" puzzled Steve.
"You said we sink your fucking boats."
And Steve understood.
"Figured I'd choose the winning side," he said.
"Right," said Simon with a smile. "Good night."
"Night, Simon,"
said Steve. And with that, Simon left the room, leaving Steve to finish clearing up. Steve scraped the uneaten food into the bin in Simon's kitchen.
"One more day," thought Steve. "Just one more day."
He felt incredibly tired now, but he would be sleeping in the chair again tonight. The fear on Simon's face had been far more convincing than the relief of his newborn hopefulness. Steve went round the flat, checking once again that everything was secure. Then, before he retired, he stopped by the kitchen once more, taking a glass of cold water from the tap. Their victory feast now felt more like the last meal of a condemned man, and the euphoria of outwitting the powers that be seemed like a distant memory. A new image loomed large in Steve's mind,
the image of a deranged serial killer who murdered his victims in the most horrible of ways.
He's big, Simon had said, like a giant.
Steve put down his glass and his eyes moved to the Sabatier knife block next to the cooker. Maybe tonight he would sleep with a little reassurance close to hand.
You stabbed me in the face with a short-bladed knife, Simon had told him.
Steve chose the longest knife in the block and went to get some sleep. Chapter 26 International Psychic Convention, Manchester. Lucifer felt sullied. To be surrounded by so many feeble, vacuous minds was sickening. He had listened to this self-glorifying fool expounding the effects of the mind over the body and how he, with his powers, could unlock their true potential. He had watched in scornful disbelief as the congregation lapped up his drivel. Only a handful of those listening showed any discernment, laughing at his pretensions and mocking his claims. These men, at least, showed some measure of will. They were big men, physically strong, some of them almost as big as he. He was pleased to see that they were not so easily duped. But no, Lucifer was not interested in anodyne frauds, no matter how ridiculous their claims might be. Those in dominion concurred. The chorus was silent. Lucifer waited until the hall had begun to empty before he left his seat. A man and a woman stepped into his path, talking excitedly about what they just heard. They looked up and apologized for their discourtesy. Lucifer graced them with a smile and they went quickly on their way. He had a good smile, although he found it an odious task to use it. But over the years he had come to acknowledge the benefits of conforming to the conventions of the inconsequential world. A face of wrath was long remembered. A smile was soon forgot. Lucifer continued up the aisle towards the exit. "Aren't you nervous?" asked Steve as they crossed the quadrangle and approached the entrance to the lecture hall.
"No," said Simon, taking hold of the door and holding it open for Steve.
Simon's optimism had persisted through the night. He had greeted Steve that morning with a cheerful air that Steve found more than a little uncomfortable. He preferred the old Simon, the unsettling Simon, the always slightly melancholy Simon. Steve gave Simon a sideways look as he went through into the lecture hall's foyer.
"Two?"
inquired a man, sitting behind a long wooden counter.
"Just one," said Simon, before Steve had a chance to speak. "I'll be taking the stand."
"Jolly good," said the man, reaching for a nearby clipboard. "Have you registered?" asked the man eagerly.
"Yes," said Simon.
"Name?"
asked the man.
"Simon," said Simon.
The man glanced down the short list of names.
"Ah, yes," he said, ticking off Simon's name. "You're sixth on the list."
The man handed Simon a small card.
"Give this to Natasha," he said, pointing through the door into the hall. "She will show you where to sit and invite you onto the stage if you get a chance to speak."
"If he gets a chance?" queried Steve.
"Depends how quickly we get through the speakers," the man explained. "Each speaker has the opportunity to introduce themselves before facing the audience and a panel of experts. They can speak for as long as they like or until the audience votes them off."
"And why would the audience vote them off?" asked Steve.
"If they're not impressed by their performance," said the man, as if this were common knowledge.
Simon met Steve's raised eyebrow with a bright, unapologetic smile. They had arrived early for the debate. Sam Delaney, sports psychic, had just finished his talk, and the hall was slowly emptying of people. They stood to one side as a group of people emerged from the exit and passed through the foyer. Then Simon and Steve went through into the hall. They passed through a small anteroom, the walls of which were lined with mirrors, and on into the main lecture hall, where the seats rose up in a broad semicircle around the stage. Natasha met them as they entered the hall. Simon gave her a dazzling smile and held out his ticket. Steve rolled his eyes as he noticed the effect this had on the young woman. This way,
she said, blushing and smiling in return, as she led Simon away towards the left-hand aisle. Steve stood there, feeling somewhat at a loss, until Simon looked back and nodded at him to take a seat. Steve glanced down the aisle, looking for somewhere to sit. People were still leaving their seats. Most were talking quietly as they left, but one group was laughing and noisily carrying on. They were all big, solid men. Rugby players, thought Steve. Probably Sam Delaney's own team come to give their psychic coach a hard time. Steve looked across the hall at Simon. Even in these innocuous surroundings, he felt uncomfortable being separated from Simon. This was the final day of their contract, and despite Simon's positive transformation, Steve still believed there was something of substance behind his fears. As he descended the shallow steps down the middle of the hall, Steve's eyes followed Simon as Natasha led him down the left-hand aisle to a bank of chairs to one side of the stage. Sorry, said Steve, distractedly, as he almost collided with a man and woman who seemed to be talking excitedly about the validity of Mr. Delaney's ideas. Sorry, Steve said again, as he bumped hard into another member of the departing audience. Steve glanced up at the figure who stopped him in his tracks. The guy was massive, several inches taller than Steve, and even in his smart blue suit, Steve could see that he was built like the proverbial brick shithouse. Sorry, Steve repeated as he stepped round the man. The big guy said nothing. He didn't seem the least bit inclined to move out of Steve's way, but he smiled as Steve edged round him. It was the smile of a charming man, a man with obvious, if somewhat Neanderthal, good looks. But Steve was not reassured, for the smile never came near the man's eyes, eyes that were so dark they were almost black. Fucking rugby players, cursed Steve as he squeezed past. He looked up to check on Simon, who had just put a hand to his head as if to ease a headache or a moment's dizziness. Natasha helped him to a chair and put a hand on his knee. Steve worked his way into a row of chairs near the front of the auditorium. He shook his head at Simon's dramatics. She's already interested, he thought. No need to play the sympathy card. But when Simon raised his head, Steve grew more concerned. There was a familiar, haunted look in his eyes. It seemed the fleeting levity of Simon's rosy outlook had come to an end. Are you all right? Steve mouthed the words. For a few seconds, Simon just looked at him uncertainly. Steve was about to rise from his seat when Simon waved him down. I'm okay, he mouthed back. The shadow had passed. Lucifer had left the building. Steve was actually enjoying this. The panel consisted of a clergyman, a scientist, a magician, calm illusionist, and a psychologist who had spent many years researching the way psychics performed their so-called supernatural feats. They were all intelligent and well-informed, and none of them had that unpleasant edge of superciliousness that often plagued the detractors of the psychic world. And up against them came the psychics, the clairvoyants, the mediums, and the rest. The first guy had been more comedian than psychic, and had been hugely entertaining until the clergyman had caught him out with a clever piece of logic. The clergyman had led the applause as the comedian left the stage. Next came a man who claimed to be able to speak to the dead. But when the psychologist gave a more impressive performance than the would-be medium, the poor man had nothing else to say. The clairvoyant made some impressive claims and dire prophecies for the future, but as there was no way to prove or disprove what she was saying, the audience lost patience and sent her packing. The fourth pretender was a spoonbender and clockmender, firmly in the mold of the great Uri Geller. But the illusionist showed the audience how such trickery was accomplished, and Uri had only one place to go. Another medium then, who claimed to be able to speak not just to the spirits of the dead, but also to animals and babies who had passed away without ever being able to talk. Despite her impressive list of satisfied clients,
she'd been unable to pass a simple challenge set her by the psychologist. "Only those who want to come through will do," she had protested as the audience invited her to leave. And then it was Simon's turn. Steve shifted anxiously in his seat as Simon crossed to the lectern in the middle of the stage. He looked at Steve and gave him the smallest of smiles as if to settle the former soldier's nerves. Then Simon lifted his eyes to the expectant faces. "Hello," he said, in a quiet, steady voice. "My name is Simon, and I am psychic." Steve looked up at Simon with a mixture of pride and embarrassment. It was like watching a psychic version of Alcoholics Anonymous.
"Hello, Simon," said the clergyman. "Can you tell us what makes you think that you are psychic?"
"The fact that I am," replied Simon, to a ripple of soft laughter.
"But what abilities do you possess?" asked the scientist.
"Many," said Simon. "Choose one and I'll tell you if I can do it." The scientist sat back in his chair, raising a contemplative hand to his chin. This softly spoken young man displayed none of the ego and self-aggrandizement that most of the other speakers had. But it was clear that he had already captured the attention of the audience.
"Can you talk to the dead?" asked the scientist.
"No," said Simon. "Why not?"
"I don't know," replied Simon, "but I believe it's because the dead no longer exist, other than as corpses in the ground and in the memories of those left behind."
The scientist seemed entirely satisfied with this answer, but there were mutterings of disapproval from amongst the audience.
"Can you read people's minds?" asked the psychologist.
"Yes," said Simon.
"Can you read my mind?"
"Yes," said Simon. The psychologist raised his eyebrows at this bold claim, and the murmurs from the audience grew louder as they began to realize there was something different going on here. The psychologist bent down and retrieved a large brown envelope from the briefcase beside his chair.
"In this envelope is a picture," the psychologist announced to the audience, holding up the envelope with more than a touch of showmanship. "Not a picture of a cross, or a moon, or a boat sailing across a wavy sea."
He looked meaningfully at the audience. They knew exactly what he was talking about. They had all seen such feats repeated by countless clairvoyants.
"This is a picture that it would be almost impossible to guess."
Here he looked directly at Simon.
"Now," he went on, "I'm going to hold an image of this picture in my mind, and you can either have a stab at guessing what it is, or you can leave the stage now and save yourself the embarrass. It's a picture of Leonardo da Vinci's giant crossbow firing an arrow at the world," said Simon, cutting across the psychologist. "Only the arrow is a pen, and the world is actually a human skull with the countries cut away to reveal the brain inside." The psychologist almost dropped the envelope. His mouth sagged open, and he could only stare at Simon. The audience waited with bated breath for him to open the envelope, which, with trembling hands, he duly did.
"Child's play," thought Steve, as the auditorium echoed to the sound of astonished gasps and enthusiastic applause.
"Give him a real challenge!"
"How did you do that?" asked the psychologist in a breathless whisper.
"I have no idea," said Simon, as the noise in the hall subsided. "All I know is that it's as clear in my mind as it is in yours." "Can you read anyone's mind?" shouted someone from the audience.
"Just about," said Simon with a quick glance at Steve.
"What about mine?" someone else called out. "And mine," said another.
"Wait, wait just a minute," said the scientist, rising from his seat and appealing to everyone to calm down.
"How do we know you didn't set this up with Martin?"
He gestured towards the psychologist, who was still quite obviously stunned by Simon's performance.
"A true scientist," said Simon, with a small smile on his lips. "Do you always demand proof?"
"Not when it's a matter of opinion or belief," replied the scientist. "But when it's a matter of fact, yes, I do."
Simon acknowledged this answer with a respectful nod.
Then his eyes suddenly fixed on the man, and the audience watched as the scientist first gaped in surprise then blushed to the roots of his thinning blonde hair. "Is that proof enough?" asked Simon, reining in his gaze.
"Yes,"
gasped the scientist. He sat down heavily in his chair and looked up into the audience, to an attractive woman sitting near the back of the hall, his face a picture of anxiety. "Don't worry about impressing her," said Simon gently. "She's already fallen in love with you." The audience laughed as the scientist blushed all over again, but the beginnings of an astonished smile showed that no damage had been done. Simon turned back to the entranced faces of the audience. There were a few moments of bewildered silence, and then the avalanche of questions began. Lucifer was waiting beneath the vaulted skeleton of a willow tree, waiting for the ridiculous debate to be over and for the heretic healer to begin her sermon and seal her fate. He had seen her arrive, this bride of speciousness, seen the fauns and the sycophants vying for her favor. He had seen her enter the hall by the door reserved for the privileged few. He would see her soon and watch with constraint as she condemned herself and left him no choice but to take her. Lucifer looked ahead to her confession, to the humbling, the question, the cleansing, and the end of all her lies. He would take his time with her. The last one had not followed the rightful order of the mass ordained by the chorus. He would make sure she knew the glory of pain before he took the breath of life from her sobbing lungs. Lucifer's spirits lifted in anticipation of the rite to come, but his expectancy was interrupted by a growing hubbub from people milling around in the quadrangle between the various rooms and halls. Lucifer widened his perception and listened to what was being said.
"That's what they're saying."
"Bullshit."
"Straight up, the guy's the real thing."
"The scientists call his bluff."
"Yeah, but he shot him down, spoke directly into his mind."
"A genuine psychic.
Let's go and see.
Can we still get in?
Is this one over here, the psychic debate?
Come on, let's go."
Despite his contempt, Lucifer was intrigued. He fell in with the swelling crowd and returned to the Hall of Lies. Steve was getting more than a little concerned. The atmosphere had changed from shock and astonishment and was rising towards a kind of hysteria. And still more people were coming into the hall. The word had obviously got around that something extraordinary was going on. He looked up at the rows of seats behind him. They were all full now, and people were sitting and standing in the aisles. Back on stage, Simon was fielding one question after another.
"So you're saying that none of the other people speaking here today are actually psychic? That none of them have supernatural powers of any kind?"
"That's right," said Simon. And Steve found himself wishing that Simon could have been a little less honest and a little more diplomatic.
"Don't you think that's incredibly arrogant?"
"It would be, if it weren't true," replied Simon.
"So they're all liars and con artists?"
"No," said Simon. "Only three of them are guilty of willful deception. The others believe their powers to be real."
"But they're not."
"No."
"Then what are they?"
"Yeah, what are they?"
Simon bowed his head. How quickly the brightness of wonderment fades to the dull flames of hostility. "People seek explanations for things they do not understand," Simon said. "Some turn to science because logic and reason prevail and endure." Here he turned to the scientist on the panel. "Some turn to God and find their answers there." The clergyman inclined his head, while others turn their gaze within to the mysteries of the mind. Simon's hand gestured towards the psychologist, but he raised his eyes to the audience. "People believe in the supernatural because they do not understand. They do not understand the amazing complexity of the human brain and the influence of the subconscious mind. They believe in the supernatural because they do not appreciate just how unendingly wonderful nature truly is."
"And you do?"
came the unpleasant challenge.
"No," said Simon. "No one fully does, but we can try. And when we reach the limits of our understanding, we must have the courage to say, 'I don't know.'"
"So what about us?"
"Yeah, are we all deluded?"
"No," said Simon. much to Steve's relief. You have simply believed in something that is not true. The audience was silent.
But we can believe in you,
said a woman from the back of the hall. If you like, said Simon with a smile. Silence again, and Steve wondered whether Simon had succeeded in calming the mob, or if it was just taking a breath before going for his throat. Then once more from the back of the hall.
My husband hears the voice of our dead son,
the woman went on, in a small, tremulous voice.
But it brings him no comfort, she said. It only makes him weep.
Simon looked up at the woman. His eyes glittered with tears. The lecture hall was full, but he spoke only to her. Liam is gone, he told her. He exists only in your hearts. The woman put a hand to her mouth. The tears spilled down her cheeks. The voices are not real, said Simon. Your husband is suffering from a mental disorder. He's grieving and he's ill. He will find no peace in chasing after ghosts. The woman was too upset to answer. She could only nod her thanks. Lucifer was inflamed. Who was this blasphemer to doubt the voice of this woman's son, to dismiss what he'd never heard? His mouth is full of curses and lies and threats. Trouble and evil are under his tongue. He had been right to follow the chattering crowds. This man was dangerous. He spoke his lies with authority. He spoke with the power of the damned. Silence claimed the crowded hall once more. The aching clarity of the woman's grief had sobered the volatile mood. Then an old man from the front row raised himself up on a walking stick that was carved in the likeness of a Jack Russell Terrier.
I once knew a priest who told me he knew a real and genuine psychic, the old man said. A child truly gifted from God, he said.
Simon held the old man's eyes, which, for all their years, were still clear and bright and had not changed.
Was he lying? The old man asked.
For the longest time, Simon said nothing. Then he smiled at the memory of a kind old priest, a memory that still warmed his soul. No, he was not lying, said Simon. He spoke of me. I knew Father Kavanagh well. The old man nodded his understanding. I loved him, said Simon. I was with him when he died. Lucifer's mind erupted in a conflagration of hate, and the chorus roared in fury. It is the witness in the house of Jehovah. He reeled with the force of revelation. He put out a hand, crushing the shoulder of the man standing in front of him at the back of the hall.
Hey! What the hell? Protested the man.
But Lucifer did not hear him. The chorus was deafening, the pain unendurable.
No one must know.
Lucifer opened his burning eyes and sought out the blasphemer at the front of the hall.
Silence the witness.
The rage was too great. It was all he could do not to rush down the steps and tear the heretic's face off there and then. The chorus was rising, the blackness encroaching on Lucifer's sight.
Cut out his tongue, fill his mouth with dirt.
He could not bear to be in the presence of such profanity and suffer it to live. Lucifer turned and fled. Steve was out of his seat. The look of absolute terror on Simon's face left him in no doubt. Any vestige of hope in Simon's mind was gone. The fear in all its fury had returned. He called out to Simon. But the rising clamor drowned out his words as people began to realize that something was wrong. Steve shouted louder, but Simon would not even look at him. He just kept staring up towards the back of the hall as if he'd seen the killer himself. Steve turned to follow the line of Simon's gaze, and as he did so, he saw the shape of a huge man in a blue suit pushing his way out of the hall. The great figure moved on through the small antechamber and disappeared. Steve looked back at Simon, but as he did so, an image froze in his mind. It was the image of the exit sign reflected in the mirrored walls of the antechamber. The ubiquitous metal box, the green sign, lit up from within, the bright letters shining clearly for all to see. T-I-X and the number 3. T-I-X-3. Exit. Chapter 27. Steve felt torn and tormented. Torn because he did not know whether to go and help Simon or go after the giant who had just left the hall. And tormented because he'd come face to face with a killer and failed to recognize what was standing before him. What was smiling down at him, smiling down with those dead black eyes. The indecision lasted less than a second. Steve went to Simon's aid. Simon, called out Steve as he leapt onto the low stage. The members of the panel were gathered hesitantly round Simon, who had collapsed to the floor and was clinging to the base of the lectern, like a man caught in a flood, fearful of being swept away. It's all right, said Steve, as the scientist moved to block his approach. He's a friend of mine.
That's right, he is, said the young woman called Natasha,
when the scientist looked doubtfully at Steve. He just collapsed, said the scientist, as Steve knelt down beside Simon. Is it some kind of seizure? Asked the psychologist. Is there anything we can do? He gets these attacks, said Steve, vaguely. Then,
Simon! It's Steve! Can you hear me?
But Simon just clung to the lectern, his face pressed against the hard edges of wood.
He's here!
He's here! He's here!
Simon whispered over and over, his eyes staring blindly ahead of him, his brow beaded with sweat.
Is he all right?
Asked Natasha, crouching down next to Steve, a glass of water in hand.
He'll be fine, said Steve, although he did not really believe it. Let's get him to a chair. A chair was brought from across the stage, but it took all Steve's strength to pry Simon's hands free from the lectern.
He's here. He's here. He's here.
Steve half carried Simon to the chair.
What's wrong with him?
Asked Natasha.
He'll be all right, said Steve, with more annoyance than he intended.
Simon just sat there, gripping his knees, rocking backwards and forwards, whispering over and over. Steve took his head in his hands, gripped him firmly, and turned his face to look up at him.
Simon, said Steve, Simon, look at me.
It was several long moments before Simon's eyes focused on Steve. And then the tension melted from his face, and Simon began to weep.
Steve!
He said in a voice that was so forlorn that Steve felt the tears standing in his own eyes.
He's here!
I know, said Steve. I know. Still clasping Simon's head, Steve looked into his sad grey eyes. That chink of fear had opened up in his mind once more. Not fear for himself, but for Simon. He could not bear the thought that he might be hurt, that he might be killed. Simon had hired Steve to protect him.
Keep me safe,
Simon had said, but for the first time, Steve truly doubted that he could. If Simon had seen it, how could he possibly stop it?
You saw him, said Simon suddenly.
Steve nodded.
I actually apologized to the bastard, he said.
You saw him, repeated Simon, as if he'd not heard Steve. Did you see the hatred and the pain? Did you hear the chorus of angels in his mind?
Steve shook his head, frowning at the strangeness of Simon's words.
They're not angels, hissed Simon ominously. They're demons. They hold him in thrall. He's the vessel of their torment, the instrument of their wrath. The small crowd of people gathered round Simon drew back at the alarming change in his tone of voice. Concern changed to discomfort and awkwardness.
Come on, said Steve, angrily. Let's get you out of here.
He drew Simon's arm across his shoulders and hauled him to his feet. Then we're calling the police.
No, cried Simon. No, Steve, you mustn't.
Police? Inquired the psychologist anxiously as Simon seemed to become increasingly debilitated. Why would we need to call the police? Steve groaned. He was not about to tell them that a serial murderer had just vacated the building and might, even now, be prowling around outside. With Simon hanging deliriously from his shoulder, Steve turned about looking for the quickest way out of the building. He spotted a fire exit at the back of the stage and forged a path towards it, the people parting nervously before him.
"Can I help?"
came a quiet voice beside him. It was Natasha. "You could get that door," said Steve, nodding towards the exit. Natasha moved ahead to the set of double doors.
"It's closed,"
she said apologetically, as Steve approached the door. The bar across the doors was sealed by a small plastic security tie. Natasha held it up between her fingers. Steve looked down at the tie, then nodded Natasha to stand aside. Then he raised a foot and gave the doors a hefty kick. The plastic tie flicked away as the doors slammed open. There were gasps of shock and disapproval from the stage behind them, but Steve could not have cared less. Hitching Simon higher on his shoulder, he started through the doors.
"Will he be all right?"
asked Natasha as he passed. "I hope so," said Steve, pausing in the doorway to look at her. "Thanks," he said.
"He's special, isn't he?"
said Natasha, her hand starting to reach out to Simon. "Yes," said Steve, "he is." And with that, he marched Simon quickly back to their car before the campus security or anyone else could stop them. Lucifer would not have seen them if he'd been waiting with the crowds, but the closeness of so many people had been more than he could bear. He'd retired to a quieter vantage point where he could watch the entrance to the Hall of Lies and calm the din of righteous ire that raged in his mind. And then he had seen them slinking from the back of the building, the accursed witness and his guardian angel. He watched them as they moved between the cars. He followed closer now, watchful, wary. The guardian angel was not a man like other men, Lucifer could see that. He knew a predator when he saw one. He would take care with that one. They stopped at a car and the angel propped up the witness while he opened the door. Lucifer crossed quickly to his van. He must move with care, with guile, lest the angel mark his presence. He slipped inside, started the engine, and waited for them to leave. Steve bundled Simon in through the passenger door and watched as he curled into a fetal position, making it impossible for Steve to fasten his seatbelt. "Sod it," thought Steve, closing the door and moving quickly round to the driver's side. He jumped in, started the car, and drove quickly out of the car park, heading away from the psychic convention and away from the man who would do Simon harm. Beside him, Simon cowered in his seat, muttering incoherently. "Hang on, Simon," said Steve. "We're going to get you home. Then I'm phoning the damn police." Simon could manage nothing more than a stifled protest. He was lost in a life's worth of fear. Lucifer was careful not to get too close, but still he dare not lose them. Those in Dominion would not be forgiving if he were to let the witness go a second time. It was 14 years since his first killing, 14 years since the priest had failed to stop him and died for his sin, for his shame. But the witness had heard him. The witness knew what he had done. The witness must be silenced. Lucifer was calmer now. The pain had lessened, the tumult subsided. But the chorus had not retreated. It hovered over the deep, waiting to see that he would not fail. Steve was having difficulty concentrating on the road. Simon kept twisting in his seat, making it difficult to move the gear stick. He was sweating and mumbling like a man caught in the grip of a nightmare. "Pain and death," he muttered. "All is pain and death." "It's all right, Simon," said Steve, reaching out a hand to calm him. "We're almost there." Steve kept glancing down at Simon, growing more concerned by the minute. And when Simon slipped down into the footwell beneath his seat, Steve just let him lie there. He was driving on autopilot, navigating the traffic with one eye always on his tormented passenger. He barely glanced in his rearview mirror. He did not notice the stealthy shadow that matched their every turn. The black van that followed them like a hearse. Lucifer hung well back. He drew the van into the curb. The car had stopped outside a house. A row of large motorcycles lined up on the road ahead of it. He waited to see if this was the place where the witness lived. Yes, there. The angel climbing out of the car, moving round to get the witness, dragging him out, heaving him up the driveway like a boneless cripple. Where are your bold words now? Thought Lucifer. Your boasts and your certainty, has your courage failed in the presence of the chorus? Lucifer's gaze burned as he pulled back out into the road, coasting slowly down the tree-lined street. He wanted to see where they went. Knowledge was power. The more he knew, the easier it would be to overcome them. Oh, great, thought Steve as he pulled up outside Simon's flat. A biker's rally on our own fucking doorstep. There was a row of 5 or 6 bikes parked up on the road outside the neighbor's house. Many more packed onto the driveway. And, strung up between the trees on either side of the drive, a crude banner fashioned from a white bedsheet. Welcome home, Spike, the banner read. Steve shook his head and climbed out of the car. He went round to the passenger's side and manhandled Simon out of the car. Then, with Simon barely able to walk, he shuffled awkwardly towards the flat. Holding him up against the door, he felt in Simon's pockets for the key. That's it, Simon, he said. We're back at the flat.
He's here. He's here,
moaned Simon, looking at Steve through his watery eyes. I know, said Steve. It's okay, you're home now.
No,
said Simon, but all assertiveness had gone from his voice, and Steve took little notice of his objection. Let's get you upstairs, he said, and as he closed the door, a black van cruised slowly past the house. Had he not been so distracted, Steve would surely have noticed the slow speed of the van. Had he not been so distracted, he would have recognized the unusually large shape of the van's driver. But as it was, he did not. The van just grazed his peripheral vision and was gone. Then, without a second thought, Steve closed the door and turned to face the stairs. It wasn't until he had driven past a second time that Lucifer made sense of the house. It was split into two flats, one up and one down. The lights in the upper flat had come on, and he caught a fleeting glimpse of the angel through the large bay window. We have you now, he thought, turning off the road, to check the area and to see how he would come at the house. He had seen a small pedestrian footpath leading off down the side of a neighbor's house. He would head round the block to see where it led. Perhaps it would offer a less conspicuous approach. Lucifer surveyed the terrain and laid his plans. He would wait till dark, and then, chorus willing, he would take the witness. Chapter 28. Steve ceased his pacing and crossed once more to the window. Where the hell are they? He cursed. It was over 3 hours since he'd first called the police, more than 30 minutes since they had last assured him that someone would be with them directly. It was dark now, and Steve peered up the street, hoping to see the lights of an approaching police car. If they did not come soon, he would pack Simon into the car and take him down to the police station himself. Steve glanced in the other direction, to the house next door, where Simon's rowdy neighbors seemed to be warming up for the evening. The noise from the bikers' homecoming party was getting louder by the minute. With an irritated snort, Steve stepped back from the window and went over to check on Simon. Simon sat hunched in the armchair as he had for hours, knees drawn up against his chest, head tilted to one side, staring into space. He was traumatized. Insensible.
Steve had not been able to get a coherent sentence out of him since they got back to the flat. He had tried gentle reasoning and stern commands, but all to no avail. Now he knelt once more beside his chair and lifted the fourth mug of tea with which he had tried to coax Simon out of himself.
"Why don't you just try and drink something?" he suggested,
although he knew it was less for Simon's benefit than for his own reassurance. If Simon would just take a drink, do something normal, at least that would give Steve something to work with, some way of breaking through this wall of fear. But Simon did not even register the tea. His gaze simply passed through the cloud of steam, as it did through Steve. Steve put the mug of tea down beside Simon's chair. He sat back on the sofa, a twisted knot of frustration.